Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year's San Francisco 9th Annual Green Film Festival is screening 60 new films with a focus on solutions and environmental justice. The festival runs now through Sunday. And for those of you who cannot make the festival or live outside of the Bay Area, we will definitely ask about how you can see some of the films that we discuss on today's show. One of those films is Once Was Water. It takes us to Las Vegas, a city with a population of 2.5 million people. Every year, a whopping 43 million people visit Las Vegas. It's one of the driest cities in the country, and it's currently in its 17th year of a drought cycle. Vegas gets an average of 4 inches of water every year. Once Was Water documents the current challenges that our water resources face. States in the Colorado River Basin have endured a 19-year drought, one of the worst in U.S. history. But since then, Nevada has taken drastic conservation measures through a drought contingency plan to help save Lake Mead, the greatest water source in Las Vegas, from drying up. And today we are joined by Christopher Beaver. His latest film is Once Was Water. It's featured at this year's Green Film Festival. It'll be screening at the Roxy Theater this Sunday at 6 p.m., and you can find more information about the film at yourcallradio.org. Christopher writes, produces, and directs multimedia projects with a focus on the human experience of the environment. His films include the Emmy Award-winning documentary Dark Circle, Treasures of the Greenbelt, and Secrets of the Bay, Tales of the San Joaquin, a river journey about California's Central Valley. And Christopher joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on this very auspicious day with big happenings in Washington.
Oh, gosh. Yes, and we decided to let the rest of the media talk about impeachment proceedings while we continue focusing on the climate.
Okay, I agree with that.
It's just so important. You know, before the break, you were asking me, have you been to Las Vegas? And I said, actually, I don't really go to Las Vegas, although I did on election day for John Kerry driving people to the polls. And you said that it gets a bad rap by certain people, but it's an incredible place with so much diversity and a lot of people who are not accepted, I should say, by their families in many cases, go to Las Vegas.
Yes, Las Vegas is a very, very special city, not least of all because it is the driest city in the United States. But no, Las Vegas is a place where it's a place of refuge in a way. People can come from smaller towns, larger towns, places where they're not accepted, and there's hope. It's a city of dreams. And I also will talk to a lot of people and say, well, mention Las Vegas. What do you think of Las Vegas? Oh, I hate Las Vegas. And say, well, you ever been to Las Vegas? Yeah, I was there a year ago. I went with a group of girlfriends we met there, and we had a good time. So it's a very, on the surface, a city of extravagance and a city of waste. But one of the things that the producer who had the original idea for this film, Diana Fuller, and I said to each other while we were making the film is, judge not lest you be judged. I don't judge what they do in terms of their industry. A lot of it is resorts. A lot of it is gambling. I don't judge L.A. because the movies are made there. I don't judge places. What we're trying to do is look at water and the reality and the through line of water.
I was also really surprised to learn that Las Vegas does some incredible water conservation. I mean, the story that we get is there's so much sprawl there, there's not much water. Why does it keep growing?
Well, Las Vegas is not alone. Las Vegas is a city in the desert. When I was making the film, I took a note out of the teachings of Francis Coppola and tried to reduce the film to a single phrase. And for me, the phrase was survival in the desert. But actually, virtually every large city in the world is a city in the desert. Very few cities have enough water within their city limits to support themselves. Los Angeles, for example, has enough water within its city limits to support 3 million people. The population of the area is 18 million. San Francisco was essentially sand dunes out here, and the water for San Francisco, the drinking water, comes from 175 miles away. And I know some of this because I actually, as I was growing up, worked in a family construction business, and I made some of the concrete that's in the Crystal Springs Reservoir system that brings water to San Francisco. So I've seen it firsthand.
So tell us just some basic facts about Las Vegas. In the film, we learn that It had a very rich history as a once lush place with watering holes where people could swim. And now it's, well, it is overdeveloped, right?
Well, overdeveloped is a really interesting concept because you have a growing population. And as a biologist once said to me, everything on the planet overpopulates, from oak trees to human beings. We overpopulate, and you can say, well, where should people go?
Right.
And I would say to somebody, said to me, well, Las Vegas, they don't have a slow growth policy, do they? And I said, well, okay, what does a slow growth policy mean? Where should those people go? You tell me, where should they go? Mm. You just tell me where they should go. And so you can say a population is an issue. It is an issue, but that's not what this film is about. Our film is about water and the through line of water and how to understand water in its cultural and social aspects as well as its environmental aspects.
And that's a great point. We're going to do another show about climate migration. Because of the climate crisis, people are going to flee all over the world. And that is the question. Where should they go?
I think that's a very big question.
Yeah. So let's talk about what Las Vegas is dealing with. As I read in the intro, it's a city with 2.5 million people. 43 million people visit Las Vegas. It's one of the driest cities in the country. It is in its 17th year of a drought cycle and gets 4 inches of water every year on average.
No, that's the situation. It is a city in the desert. But what they've done is some incredibly innovative programs that the film talks about. And I would also, by the way, say it's a film about Las Vegas. The film's a lot more fun than maybe some of these facts and figures will make it sound. You know, it's a celebration also of Las Vegas as a place where there are shows. You have Cirque du Soleil. You have rock stars coming. There's a lot going on. It is a gambling center, but that's only part of it. And of course, Las Vegas would rather have you think of it as family entertainment, I guess the way we think of Times Square in New York City these days, right, if we think about it. So Las Vegas has an awful lot going on. And they also have some of the programs that we discovered in terms of positive things that they're doing are just amazing. One of the things that they do is they pay people to remove their lawns, their turf, which wastes a lot of water. And one of the sayings, this one sticks in my brain, and I think about this a lot wherever I go. If you only walk on your lawn when you cut that lawn has to go. And so in Las Vegas now, you cannot build new homes that have a front lawn. You're allowed a small backyard lawn for barbecuing, for kids, for pets, for whatever you want. And so the whole landscape of Las Vegas is evolving. That's incredibly progressive. You are paid $2 a square foot for every square foot of lawn you remove. And there's a program in Las Vegas called Green Our Planet. Excuse me. That was started by a couple, Kira Byrne and Kim McQuarrie. Their program is to take the money that schools get from removing their turf, but not playground turf, turf where you park the bicycles, removing that turf and replacing that with organic outdoor educational gardens. Hmm. And in Nevada, which has one of the lowest per capita expenditures per student in the school system, as does California, in the city of Las Vegas, they've constructed 167 outdoor educational gardens. They also help stage the largest children's farmers market in the United States. And this is not where there's a couple little token booths for the kids from. This is a total children's farmers market, and they do that. 167 of these gardens where they're teaching organic gardening, they're teaching math, they're teaching management, self-discipline. And so what's happened is every single school that has one of these gardens, the test scores by any measurement have gone up.
Wow.
So you have the Water Authority and the Southern Nevada Water Authority collaborating with Green Our Planet, collaborating with the public school system to conserve water. So that's one of the great programs that Las Vegas does, and it's partially because they have such a high consciousness that they live in the desert.
Mm.
So I'm also fond of saying their water conservation, it's the least they could do.
Can you tell us more about this, the consciousness, and just what is the state of the environmental movement in a place like Las Vegas?
The state of the environmental movement is probably like the state of the environmental movement in many, many places. It could be better. It's not as good as one would hope. It's not as bad as one could fear. But there is an extreme awareness about water. where water comes from. So you have, for example, Cirque du Soleil, which now has 6 shows running in Las Vegas. They sell 134,000 tickets a week.
A week.
So that says something for people's affection for Las Vegas. You go there as on a family vacation. The founder of Cirque du Soleil, Guy Laliberté, has started a charity called One Drop. Now, in Las Vegas, they have different programs. One Drop provides clean drinking water in countries other than the United States. And one could think, as I did at first, oh, it's deflecting. Let's go solve the problem somewhere else and not think about what we're doing. What's happened is because of the global awareness of Cirque du Soleil, because Las Vegas knows they're in the desert, now they've started saying, well, we can share our lessons with other parts of the planet, and we can take lessons from other parts of the planet and bring them here to Las Vegas. So it's an interchange. Things are exchanged. So one of the things that they do, and we show this in the film, they have an annual show one night. All the Cirque du Soleil shows go dark on the Las Vegas Strip, and they have one show that's presented with volunteers from Cirque du Soleil that raise money for One Drop. And the scale of the fundraising is in the millions of dollars to help this program. Then they do public awareness activities also in Las Vegas. So those are just, boy, One Drop, Green Our Planet, those are like two very, very basic things that Las Vegas does that I would like to see the outdoor educational gardens everywhere.
That is incredible, I mean, on many levels, just because it's so important to teach children and get them out of the classroom and touching the soil and learning about where our food comes from.
Oh, and the kids are great, and they're so articulate. You'll see it in the film. It's one of my favorite sequences. You can see in the film, you can see the expressions on the faces of the kids, what this means to them. It's the recognition that they get, the sense of accomplishment. I sound like a proud parent, but it's true. To witness this was really a gift.
And if you want to see this film, it's called Once Was Water. It'll be featured in this year's Green Film Festival screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco this Sunday at 6 o'clock. We have listeners outside of the area. How can they see your film?
The film will be available through an organization called Bullfrog Films. There'll be streaming versions. And you can go to our website, Once Was Water, and there'll be listings there for showings in other areas. The film, by the way, is also on its way internationally, and we will be having a showing coming up next month in Turkey.
Oh, wow.
So it's very interesting. I think that water, maybe a summing up statement, but water is one of the underlying realities, if not the underlying reality, of a lot of our politics, including the national politics, including what's going on now with our President Trump. Water is an issue, and how Trump treats water and how he responds to it says a lot about who he is as a person.
Wow. How do you, you know, when we were talking before the show about all the problems that we're dealing with, we're going to talk about that IPCC report, and you said that we're in such an interesting time because we're learning so much about how much damage has been done. I mean, we can see it. We feel it. I was just reading about how PG&E is cutting power to tens of thousands of people in the area because of potential wildfires. This is in our backyard here. And at the same time, there are amazing solutions happening. So given that you have been doing this for a while, how do you square those two things?
I think we're doomed. But I think that there is a chance, and I think it comes down to individual moral responsibility. That's where the change has to start from. As someone said, first you take care of yourself, then you take care of your family and friends, then you look at your neighborhood, and then the town, and then the city, and then you keep going until you take care of the planet. But I think you have to start with individual moral responsibility, and I think once that happens and people start talking to each other, every place I've gone, no matter where I would go, including Russia, which has a, can we call it a dictatorship, and there you find people who are active on the environment. Whatever you hear about the country of Turkey, there are people who are trying to get recycling going, who are trying to conserve water. So those connections.
Same with Iran.
Same in Iran. We have been trying to go to Iran and show our film. I'll say one final thing, take a little bit time. President Trump is wrong when he talks about globalization. That the world does belong. It belongs to global consciousness. That's what I feel. We start with moral individual responsibility, and we must have global consciousness. And when we share that, that's where the hope is.
Mm. You talked about individuals taking action. I think that what is, we talk about these issues on a regular basis, and I feel like, yes, especially under this administration, these people are enabling the climate crisis to continue. I don't even think they're deniers. I think they're enablers. I think individual action is more important under an administration like this because they're taking us backwards. But at the same time, I feel like the conversation around how to hold these corporations accountable is often missing because it's so big. So how do you, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, we know the names of the big oil companies, and that's kind of where it stops.
Well, I remember there was one time at one of our film showings, some question came up like this, and there was a Native American woman, and she identified herself as such, and she said, here's what I think our teachings are. The teachings are to go to the place on the planet that you love best, or to think about the place on the planet you love best. And when you think about that, you'll know what to do. So I think it's a question of imagination. I think in terms of that we're all adults here, we can talk about the bad things and not, oh my God, I feel so terrible. I'm not enjoying my life. I shouldn't go for the bike ride. I shouldn't take a vacation. But I think it may have been on one of your shows. Somebody said, we're all adults here. We can talk about the problems and how to address the problems. We can try to help each other. I think to ignore the problems or to try to pretend, oh, we have this solution that's going to save the whole planet is, I think that's the wrong emphasis. I mean, we could do everything tomorrow to conserve water, and you're not going to bring economic and social justice to the planet, I don't think. I think you're going to help. I think there are instances where you're going to help. But I think it's one step at a time.
Hmm. I'm sure when people heard you say, I think we're doomed.
Yeah.
I'm sure that stopped people in their tracks. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, you stopped me in my tracks when you asked. And I remember speaking with Robert Haley, who's the zero waste manager of the city of San Francisco for the previous film that producer Diana Fuller and I did together, Racing to Zero. And at one point I asked him, this was not in the film, I'm walking with him, the camera's on him, and I say, well, the question you ask me, how do you feel about the environment? And he said, there is not one good environmental indicator that's going in the right direction. We're in big trouble. And if you saw the footage, you could see the camera jiggle. I was expecting a government employee, which is a reductive way of thinking about Robert. But I was thinking, you know, I'm going to get some government person saying, oh, well, blah, blah, and we will do our best, and it's all going to be okay. But I think there is a reality that's very, very serious.
Race to Zero, that I still remember that film. That was such an incredible film. It's about getting to zero waste by 2050 in some cities,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Can you just give us a quick update on that? Because China has decided to stop taking other countries' crap, for lack of a better word, now you've got trash piling up in many, many places across the country, and cities have no idea how to handle this.
Well, actually, cities do. I had a conversation recently with Robert Haley, and he said San Francisco is actually doing pretty well. He said smaller communities are having a little bit more difficult time.
Right.
Also, in terms of China, you're right. They said, stop sending us your crap, which doesn't mean don't send us your recyclables. It means stop sending us this stuff that's got plastic mixed in with the paper. And so they have gone to a point now where they want a higher level of material that they will accept. I don't know how much they're accepting. But the other thing that's happened is also China. Let's personify China. They're not stupid. They look at the planet. They know what's going on. If you've ever been in a Chinese city and experienced air pollution, Beijing or Shanghai, it's obvious. And it's obvious that that can't continue. So that China is also developing its own recycling programs. I'm going to jump to Russia, Putin. Everybody is, oh, Putin is a terrible person. Well, Putin is probably a terrible person. He comes from the KGB, the Secret Service. But Putin, a few years ago, 3-4 years ago, also chaired a national meeting in the city of Moscow to discuss how to improve industrial recycling. So these countries are not stupid. And again, I think it's a question of more like a global consciousness and cooperation, trying to figure out not like China does this and we do that. How can we work together on the problem? And how can we see solutions from all over the planet? Mm-hmm. And solutions also coming up from the bottom, coming up from young people, coming up from people dreaming, even coming up from, I'll put myself in this category, the nutcases, the people who like, oh, if I was president, I would do this and that. So I think that it's a richness of ideas. That's our hope for the future. Is the richness of ideas.
I want to ask you, going back to your film, again, we're speaking with Christopher Beaver about his latest film, Once Was Water, and I hope you can see this. It's screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco this Sunday at 6 p.m., and then if you don't live in the area or you cannot make it, we'll let you know how you can watch it online. You take us to Lake Mead in Nevada, which is very close to the Vegas Strip. It's a man-made lake, a reservoir that was formed by the Hoover Dam nearly a century ago. And we learn in the film that the water level has dropped 140 feet in the last 17 years. And if it drops 3 more feet, the state of Nevada will require official water cutbacks in the first water shortage declaration.
Yes, that's true. Arizona will be the place that's hardest hit. And they could face a cutback on deliveries to the city of Phoenix by 50%. So what's happening is all the states and Mexico that draw water from the Colorado River are taking less water than they are owed by contract and by law. So they're taking less, trying to maintain the level of that lake so it won't drop. And in this connection, it's worth also thinking that the biggest user of water from the Colorado River, it's not Las Vegas, it's California.
California.
And only recently, we had this drought, which supposedly was broken this year. We had all this rain. All of the states had voluntary cutbacks except for one, and that's California. And during that period of drought, California had what I've been told is the most productive year, agricultural year ever, because they're expanding agricultural land left and right. So one of the things about Once Was Water, it's a microcosm. We look at the city of Las Vegas. It's not cherry picking and leaping all over the world. Look at me. I've got a lot of mileage making my movie. It's a microcosm. But the lessons are the lessons to be shared, and lessons to be shared and ideas to be exchanged with other states and other nations. So the fact that California finally agreed to cut back their water use is a big step forward to understand that we're all in this together.
And finally agreed to groundwater rules for the very first time, which yeah. are still being hashed out, and it's a very ugly process.
No, I'm only laughing because, you know, in water in California, they always say they have a couple of sayings. One is that water runs uphill toward money. And the other one is supposedly Mark Twain said is that in California, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting.
Hmm. Well, Christopher, as always, it's great to have you back. I'd love to have you on for the full hour so we can elaborate on all of these issues. Christopher Beaver writes, produces, and directs multimedia projects with a focus on the human experience of the environment. His latest film, Once Was Water, is featured in this year's Green Film Festival. It'll be screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco this Sunday at 6. Will you be there?
I won't be there. I'm actually going to be filming the headwaters of the Sacramento River, but Diana Fuller, the producer, will be there. And boy, does she have stories about the making of this film.
I bet. So your next film's going to be about the Sacramento River?
Sacramento River will play into it. It'll be about the Central Valley, one of my continuing things that just obsesses me. And you could be making films about the Central Valley and water from now until the water freezes over.
Yes. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Thank you so much for all your great work.
And thank you very much, Rose.
Coming up after a break, we will speak with Peter Nelson, another filmmaker whose film will be featured at the festival. We will talk about his documentary, The Pollinators, which is about threats to honeybees and efforts to save them. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You could also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Two things, the president and impeachment, and then having children and climate change will be the topics of discussion. That's actually four things on 1A coming up at 11 o'clock, one half hour from now, right after Your Call.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about a couple of the films featured at the 9th Annual Green Film Festival in San Francisco. And coming up in about 20 minutes, we will talk about a devastating new report just released from the IPCC looking at how global warming is drastically affecting the oceans. Joining us now is Peter Nelson, a filmmaker, cinematographer, beekeeper, and director. And we're talking about his latest film, The Pollinators, which recently won the Excellence in Environmental Filmmaking Award. It is about threats to honeybees and the incredible beekeepers who are trying to save them. The Pollinators is playing at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco this Saturday at 8:30 p.m. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Peter. He's joining us from KUOW in Seattle. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you. A lot has changed since you were on the show. You have won an award for excellence in environmental filmmaking, as well as several other awards. So congratulations for that. Your film is really amazing.
Well, thank you very much.
And then I also wanted to ask you about what has happened with pesticides, especially under the Trump administration. The environmental law organization Earth Justice, along with a group of concerned beekeepers, are suing the EPA over its decision to restore the use of a pesticide called, is it
Sulfoxaflor,
thank you. Yeah. And this is known to harm bees and other pollinators. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, it had limited approval, and this administration has reapproved it, and it sort of expanded its use to be much more commonly used. I think there was a pressure by some farmers to do that, but it goes against, it's a known bee-killing and pollinator-killing pesticide. And so it's a real problem for beekeepers, and it's really kind of a step back.
Let's step back and talk about what bees are currently facing right now. According to data from the Bee Informed Partnership, between October 2018 and April of this year, about 41% of the managed honeybee population declined. And these are colonies kept by commercial beekeepers. So please remind us again, why are honeybees dying in such record numbers?
Yeah, I think there are multiple reasons why they're dying. There's, there are parasites. Varroa mite is a big issue. Pesticides, as we mentioned, is a huge issue that either get sprayed directly or pollinators pick up indirectly. But also loss of habitat, climate change is a factor, and then viruses that are transmitted by the mites are sort of all problems, along with poor nutrition, through lack of diversity in their forage. So all those different issues are conspiring to really make it very hard for beekeepers to keep their bees alive.
What was so amazing to me in the film, Peter, is to watch how far bees travel because they're so under threat. And almond farmers, for example, in California might just give the beekeepers 2 or 3 days notice. And then, boom, they've got to get in their trucks. They drive overnight. They end up in California, and the bees do their incredible work.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible to watch. And it's, I should point out that these, not driven by the beekeepers, but it's really this change and expansion of movement of managed honeybees by beekeepers is really driven by the changes in agriculture as we've gone to, bigger monocultures and more simplified agriculture. And almonds is probably the most glaring example of that. And so the beekeepers they get their bees ready. They move, most of the beekeepers in the north move their bees down south. So their bees are sort of ready to go. They, build up the hives as best they can and get them ready because when the almond bloom happens, they want the bees in place. And because it's agriculture and it's nature, those things don't happen on a schedule. They happen on a schedule depending on what happens in the environment. So if it's warm or wet or cold, all those things affect that timing. And so the beekeepers sort of have to be kind of ready. They have a general window in February when they need to have their bees out there, but there's no precise date. And so they get a call and they say, we need our bees tomorrow. And then they do their best, or, a couple of days down the road. Tomorrow is a bit of an exaggeration, but a couple of days down the road, they have to move their bees in and get them ready, because if they miss that bloom, it can really affect the crop. And it's not just almonds. It's all the crops are like that, apples and blueberries and cranberries. And so much of what we eat is pollinated by these managed honeybees.
Can you talk more about that, about the process involved in these honeybees pollinating so much of the food that we eat on a regular basis?
Yeah, there. I think there are about 400 crops that are, you know, pretty common. Is the general rule is one out of every three bites of food we eat is something pollinated by an insect, and so we're really dependent upon these bees. And managed honeybees have come in to sort of fill in the gap from the native pollinators that are there. And so, as agriculture has gotten more simplified and expanded into more monocultures, then there's less habitat, less nutrition, or less forage for native bees, and so. A bee, if you know you're living in an almond orchard, native bees, you know, or a honeybee, even if it was wild there, wouldn't be able to survive for most of the year because the almonds only bloom for 5-6 weeks at the most, and so they have to move the bees in for the pollination and then take them out again because otherwise the bees wouldn't have any way to survive. And so it's the honeybees have kind of filled in this gap and are somewhat of an insurance policy, if you will, for many farmers to ensure pollination, which is a necessity for agriculture to have a crop.
Honeybees pollinate $15 billion of food crops in the United States every year.
At least.
Wow. I mean, it's hard to imagine what happens if we don't have the current amount of honeybees doing all of this pollination.
Yeah, it's kind of a scary prospect. And, you know, it's something that when I started this project, you know, I got a feel from the beekeepers and I followed, you know, 7 different commercial beekeepers around at different points in the year over a pollination season. And, you know, nobody ever came out and told me, we're worried about this, but I could tell that they were because your losses are, you know, 33 or 50 or sometimes higher depending on what state you're working in or what states you're working in. That's not sustainable. You know, losses, they can divide honeybees, the colonies, and they will, their population will, you know, can be, you know, brought back up to some extent. But it's a lot of stress on the bees to do that. And so the losses are high, and I think that that's a, you know, really scary prospect for these beekeepers that, you know, have 40% or 50% losses. It's not sustainable long term.
Mm. You know, the other thing I was struck by, Peter, is to learn about just how much beekeepers really love their bees. I mean, they really care about their bees. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's so true. I think that, you know, you see these images of the beekeepers and the beehives are palletized. So you have 4 hives or 6 hives on a pallet, and then they put them on semis to move them around the country. And there's something that's kind of sort of industrial about it on one level. But these beekeepers, you know, my experience with them was that they really care about their bees. They're treated not as pets. They're considered as livestock by the USDA, but these beekeepers really have a great admiration and respect and love their bees in many ways. It's not only their livelihood for them and their families, but it's very personal to them. And you don't work around stinging insects unless you really have a great fondness for them.
And finally, Peter, we talked about this when you were on the show last, but remind us, how can people get involved in their own communities? On your film's website, you list a number of organizations working to better pollinator health. You know, so many people are passionate about this issue. What can we do to try to save the bees?
Well, there's so many things, and it's one of the things I really, really love about this topic and I've enjoyed as, you know, making this film is that there's something that literally everybody can do. It's a totally actionable topic, and that could be as simple as, you know, buying honey from a local beekeeper, certainly buying honey from a U.S. beekeeper because there's so much fraudulent honey out there, which is a whole other story.
Hmm.
But creating habitat is something that, you know, can be done, and it was interesting to hear Christopher talk about that in the previous segment about, you know, replacing lawns and having pollinator education gardens in schools. And people can do something in their communities, on their property, in the window boxes even make a difference. And, you know, those little bits of habitat make a big difference for bees in many environments. But not using, you know, pesticides, not using fungicides, not using herbicides are all things that are very important for not only directly killing bees, but killing the stuff that bees feed on. And then there's, you know, then there's the political action aspect of it is that people can get involved in local community and right up to state and federal level to try and change policy. And that's really important. And supporting your local agriculture, you know, going to the farmers market and talking to your farmers about who, you know, who they are, what they grow, you know, just learning about your food and start asking those questions is a huge part of this and make the difference. I really wanted to connect people to where their food comes from and try and understand a little bit about the, you know, the essential role that honeybees have on what we eat every day, every meal.
And since you brought up honey, I bet you raised some eyebrows there when you said try not to buy from fraudulent producers. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that so much of the honey that comes in from overseas is suspect. It's kind of difficult to tell, but if you have honey that comes in from Asia, some from South America, there's a good bet that it could be fraudulent. And what people do is they thin it with rice syrup or another type of syrup to kind of stretch the honey, if you will. They put a lot of honey on the market that comes into this country, and it really hurts the local beekeepers. Because these beekeepers, you know, the commercial beekeepers have basically two revenue streams. They have, you know, the pollination contracts where they get paid by the farmers to bring in their bees to pollinate the crops. But then most of them also produce honey, and that's another, you know, stream of revenue for them. And so supporting those people, you know, supporting that aspect of it is really important.
Well, Peter, thank you again for joining us, and thanks for making this great film. We'd love to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Peter Nelson is a filmmaker, beekeeper, and director. His latest film, The Pollinators, recently won the Excellence in Environmental Filmmaking Award, and it is playing at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco this Saturday at 8:30 p.m. And if you're not in the area, you can go to yourcallradio.org to find out how you can